related about the complaint from Shirley McLean, and that Bob Hope was, did in fact,
special.
Did in fact come on Sunday, June 16th. His advance people had been there. I might say when I was back in the United States in February, Jerry Ford had contacted me to, would I put in a good word with the Chinese for the Bob Hope venture. And frankly, I did, because I thought it was advantageous politically at that stage of the game to have it known that someone who was identified with the conservative right, not the radical right, but conservative right, is having an obviously affirmative view of the new relationship. And he and his people behaved very well and did everything they could to get along with the Chinese. There were only two incidents that came along, both involving Democracy Wall, which of course then was getting into had already gotten into the difficult stage as far as the authorities in China were concerned. The first time he was being filmed at Democracy Wall, putting up a poster in English, and he was doing it very furtively, first looking over his left shoulder and then looking over the other shoulder to see if he was being observed. When the Chinese saw this, they said that was unacceptable. It made him look as, made it look as though he was worried about the police catching him putting something about Democracy Wall. And that just was unacceptable. Hope's explanation to them had been that it was a poster announcing his July 4th show. And he didn't want to have anybody see him putting up a show about himself. The Chinese did not accept that explanation. And so he agreed, okay, they would not use it in the final show. They accepted his word. I might say that for whatever reason, there was a great coolness between Huang Jun, who was Minister of Culture at this point, and who I guess officially was his host, and the Hope Party. And Huang Jun did not finally see Hope until they'd been there some time. In fact, he was on the verge of leaving, not leaving China, but leaving Peking to go to to Shanghai. Yeah, it was Friday, July the 6th. And let me digress a minute. I had asked Bob Hope if he would consider putting on a show on the 4th of July, because this 4th of July was obviously special, the first 4th of July we were to celebrate after normalization. The 4th of July celebrations had somewhat gotten out of hand anyway for our small facilities. In 76, to celebrate the bicentennial, they put on quite a show. And it was divided into two parts. One at 11 o'clock to go till 12 for Chinese guests only, and then one in the evening for the diplomatic community, but then also for tourists. And it depended to some extent on the weather being good. Well, July, as you know, is part of the rainy season in Peking. But they were lucky, and again in 77 and 78. But they were relatively small affairs. If necessary, could all have been contained indoors. In 79, just we decided to have one big one. And we really gambled on the weather. And I wanted to also cap it off with a performance in the evening. For a Bob Hope show. And he was very willing. And the Chinese, after due consideration, also agreed. So he put on this show, which also included the actor who is now in the current
Marco Polo series,
who played Kublai Khan. What's his name?
Yan.
Right. Who speaks excellent English, excellent idiomatic English. And he acted as Hope's interpreter. And was very funny in that role. So it so happened the 4th of July 1979 in Peking was a beautiful day. We had very careful logistics. All cars had to be parked outside the gates. Not even VIPs could come in. They came in through the main gate and then were carefully came by a receiving line which led them into the small unused court really between the embassy building and the residence, and that would take them into the patio of the residence and into the residence, and then they come out the other way. And we had 1,500 people that day, so it was very good. Yeah. And then in the evening to have this wonderful show.
Hot dogs for everybody. You had some flown in, didn't you? Have a whole pile of stuff, as I vaguely.
They'd always flown in the hot dogs, but we had some logistic problems in bringing the hot dogs for 79 for such a huge number. And Sharon and I sampled the Chinese hot dogs, which we found quite good. So we served hot dogs, yes, but they were Chinese hot dogs, not American hot dogs. And it went very well in that regard. So it was a very auspicious July the 4th. I might say that...
Who came?
Wang Hua, Wang Zhen. What vice premier came? I think Wang Hua. No, I think Wang Hua was the...
Not yet a vice premier, was he?
Fang Yi was the vice premier.
Yeah, but Wang Hua was not.
No, not at that point.
Okay.
I don't think a vice premier came. In fact, we were hesitant about inviting, although we did invite, finally, Deng Xiaoping, because he'd been there on the 1st of January, and Fang Yi had been there on the 1st of January. But Wang Hua was the ranking Chinese. But we'd also, in our planning, agreed that after that, then come 1980, we would have a much simpler affair. And so we went back to having a noontime affair in general, but to a limited invitation list. And then to have an open house at what we called Independence Hall at one of the other sites, American sites, to which there was a general invitation, and in which which was done in conjunction with the American Club, and where the drinks were sold for a nominal price, because we were putting an undue amount of the entertainment fund into the just the one event of July the 4th. Plus, it looked like we were trying to outshine some other countries, which I thought was inappropriate. So from 1980, and I presume continued since, it's been on a more conventional basis. So Huang Jun had not met with Bob Hope until on the Friday, July the 6th, which was 2 days after the 4th of July affairs. And Huang Jun specifically sent the message that I was to come with him. And we went out to the Ministry of Culture, and it was a rather uncomfortable affair.
John Thompson went with you, didn't he?
Yes, John Thompson.
Because John has described it
right.
to me.
And Huang Jun would address me across Hope sitting between us. Until the meeting was well underway, when Bob Hope, I must say, handled it very well and kept responding to him, and I tried to stay out of it as much as possible. So that by the end of the meeting, it was...
What is Bob Hope like in a serious situation? Is he still fighting?
He's a very, very decent human being. He's very unassuming. I note that on the evening before this, on Thursday, July the 5th, we had a reception for the Bob Hope group at the residence, to which we invited all the families of the embassy, particularly all the children, because Big Bird was part of the Bob Hope group, and all the children were waiting to have the autographs, not from Bob Hope, but from Big Bird, who of course was not in costume. But the kids were all grouped around Big Bird and his wife, who were also a very engaging couple. And Bob Hope just was sitting around chatting with people. It didn't bother him that he was not the center of attention. He was also part of the gathering of the Isaac Stern concert, to which I'll come in a couple of minutes. And
let me just say, I've talked to John Thompson about the problem. Are you going to come to the problems of getting Bob Hope's film out of the country?
Yes. That took place a few days later. I was called down to the foreign ministry to meet with Han Xu, and Bill Stubbs went with me, not John Thompson. And Han Xu was quite nervous because he had to tell me that they were going to Chinese customs was going to seize all the videotapes made by the Hope people. And because, again, it involved Democracy Wall. It seems that on the very day that they were getting ready to leave Peking, they'd gone back to Democracy Wall to have another filming. And this time they put up a poster, also in English, but they just put it up in a normal way. But this poster was criticizing American political problems, inflation, and I forget, but there were domestic American matters. Well, that was entirely unacceptable and inappropriate because you did not put on a Chinese wall in a foreign language comments about another country. that was unwarranted interference in the internal affairs of that country, and that they had demanded, as with the earlier Democracy Wall item, that this not be included in the show. And there had been some difficulty that their negotiations were with Linda Hope, who acts as manager of Hope Enterprises. Finally, she had indicated, no, they wouldn't, but by this time, they had drawn up an agreement which guaranteed to the Chinese that it would not be used. And by the time the agreement was drawn up, Miss Hope had said to them, on advice of lawyers, she was not going to sign that agreement. And they would determine what they would do with their own material when they got back to the United States. And so based upon this answer, they wanted me to know, as the ambassador, that they had regrettably come to the decision to seize all the materials. And I said, are they still in Shanghai? Yes, they're still in Shanghai. They were to leave either later that day or the next day. Not all the party was leaving. Some were staying behind to do other work. But Bob Hope was leaving, his wife Dolores, and Linda Hope, and the producer. But then I got word afterwards, either later that day or I think the next morning, that when, in fact, Customs was seizing materials, Linda Hope then wanted to know, where is the document, where is the contract, I will sign it. And there was some delay until they could find that document, which he then signed, and at that point they released the materials. I don't think there was ever any newspaper story about it.
Right.
It was, of course, Democracy Wall itself, about which they were.
And the issue of also covering over a couple things, too, I think was just that was used as another excuse.
Yes.
They had tampered with the right of the Chinese to express themselves by putting their own poster over it. And here was some document that was quite important, and the group whose wall poster had been covered up had apparently protested to the authorities about this infringement on their civil liberties.
That, of course, was really an excuse, because there was so much traffic at that wall that if a poster was up overnight, that it was free game to tear it down and put another one up or put another one right on top of it.
Do you think that the Chinese were at all concerned or shocked by some of the dances in the Hope Show? For example, Peaches and Herb dancing on the Temple of Heaven steps. Was that cause?
Well, first on the July 4th, Peaches and Herb had a dance, and she wore diaphanous materials, but had a body sheath under. But even so, I was a little nervous about the Chinese reaction. But during the performance itself, they seemed to love it. And we had taken pains to see that all our household staff had tickets, and they were all there. And the next morning, we asked those who were on duty that morning how they liked the show, and they liked the show very much. What did they like the best? Well, the men liked Peaches dancing. I asked Bob Hope, had they had any complaints about Peaches dancing at the Temple of Heaven? And yes, they'd had a complaint from a couple of American tourists. It was a terrible thing to do at a sacred place with Chinese. Of course, the Chinese is not a sacred place in that sense, and apparently there were no problems at all. I think, in fact, they'd had that cleared ahead of time. But
well, your wife, right, Huang Jun, I got from John Thompson, too, was not enamored by that whole performance. But it's not clear what the origins of his hesitancy were. The Bob Hope special owes its existence in part to Richard Nixon. He was the one who first raised it on a very early, I think on his 72 trip.
Oh, really?
Yes. And then I think it was even a matter of discussion for Secretary Kissinger. Nixon kept pushing it. We had never made it a specific object in our discussions with the Chinese, but they, not only had President Ford raised it, but it went back to President Nixon.
I see. I didn't know that.
Well, it's one of those ideas of how to use television to break down the barriers between our two societies. It's not clear to me why it took so long to get it. I suppose the Maoist era was reluctant to endorse a program of that sort.
I would think so, you know, and the way they handled the Philadelphia Orchestra would indicate that they were very gun-shy of taking a chance with something like Bob Hope's special. But when it finally happened, I thought the show was very good in terms of the American audience, the fact that such a person would get a huge audience, which would help break down the fears and antipathies that the ordinary person had about China and this new relationship. I think in a political sense, it was a great contribution.
I agree.
I noticed, too, that at this point, Ruth Eckstein was visiting China. And I think she had a very wonderful trip.
Yes, she did.
I think I mentioned the Conference of Mayors. And Isaac Stern was here, was in China at the same time. And we had the buffet dinner was given by the Chinese for him in the Peking Hotel, and we had a reception at the residence on the evening of Wednesday the 20th. But then the next morning, in order that we could talk, and it was the only time that we could work it into his schedule, we had breakfast for Isaac Stern and his family. State Roy was there, and Sharon and I. And he inquired at one point why there were so few foreigners at his concert. Is it that they were not interested? And I said, no, not at all. Because the Chinese were so hungry for these performances that their policy was to give only a few tickets to the embassy of the country from which the artist came. But no tickets beyond that were available. All the remaining tickets were reserved for Chinese. The result was that although there was a great desire in the diplomatic community, that there was no opportunity. And you remember the dining room there that opened into the reception room, and his back was to the reception room, but he looks over his shoulder at it and looks around. He said, would you mind if I gave a concert here? I was very thrilled to have him say that, you know, to have a man of his stature say, mm-hmm. Would you mind? And so we made that arrangement and made it for the following Saturday night. It was very hot that day. And we ran the air conditioners, you remember, just window air conditioners, to try and cool the place off as much as possible. but impossible to have a concert with those running because they were very noisy. So shortly before the concert, we had to turn them all off. Then we had some, the throng was so great that we had seats out in the patio. And therefore I had to have the windows open. So it was very hot inside by the time all those people jammed into that relatively small space. Everybody came dressed very properly. We didn't have the time to send out formal written invitations. We called people because the time was so short. I guess we did send out written invitations too. I didn't have the presence of mind to put on their casual attire. I was the only one who was dressed casually. And
Isaac Stern, presumably.
We used the little sitting room off for his, when he looked at me, he takes off his jacket, takes off his tie, and then he goes out and says, well, it's good enough for the ambassador, it's good enough for me. Why, it should be good enough for you, but nobody else took off any jackets or anything. And he said, well, this is the first concert I've given him in a sauna. And he had an excellent pianist with him. And luckily, we had gotten to the budget some months before, provision for the purchase of a grand piano, which was new and which we'd had tuned so that it was acceptable. And it was a remarkably wonderful concert. One of the high points of that time. On that, in that same period, Joe Califano came.
Let's turn to that in a minute, but now you've just described two cultural exchanges representing different parts of the American cultural tradition, the diversity of our culture. It is also a period when the Taiwan Relations Act has been passed, but and introduced an irritant in the relationship, but yet this was a period of extraordinary warmth in Sino-American relations, the democracy wall, to which I want to return in a minute, indicated that the 20-some years of Maoist indoctrination had not eliminated Chinese thinking about individual rights, individualism. There were appeals put up in hopes that Jimmy Carter would read of particular wall posters. What were your? Do you recall some of your thoughts at this perhaps most euphoric moment in Sino-American relations as to what the potential of the relationship held, not in a strategic sense, let's dismiss that, not even an economic sense, but in the sense of two peoples coming together, in the sense of bridging our cultural differences?
Well, of course, the first insight into the tremendous hunger of the Chinese for a culture that is universal was shown in March when the Boston Symphony came, and the tremendous outpouring of enthusiasm and excitement that was really almost was awe-inspiring. I was not present at the Isaac Stern concert or of any of his master concerts. Seen it secondhand, of course, in the documentary that he made from Mao to Mozart. But the fact that he could, without speaking the language, in front of a mass audience, correct these Chinese artists and violinists as to how to hold the violin. And if you do it this way, mimicking what they had done, you are saying nothing. But if you do it this way, and then giving it back to them, and they would pick it up almost immediately, but taking absolutely no offense, and the audience being so totally sympathetic, not only to the teacher, master, but also to the pupil. And the fact that, as he says in the film, what is the difference between these players that I see who are 10 and 11, who are so exquisite in their tone, and those who are 20 and 30? Well, the Cultural Revolution is the difference when they were stifled and in many cases physically maltreated. The Democracy Wall incident never excited me in any sense of this being a reaching out of two political cultures. I looked upon it always as being essentially peripheral, and maybe a political gimmick being utilized for the connection with the factional struggles that were going on within the Chinese Communist Party and system, and even went in its regressive phase. Obviously, I was not happy about that, but I look around and could see the continued relaxation of the system itself, and the relaxation among the Chinese people, which was so really visible, and of them and the authorities, you could see it on the street in the relationship between the average citizen and the policeman. When I first went there, they were afraid. Watch and see, they were no longer afraid, and sometimes would speak back. And this was going on at the same time the arrests were taking place of the dissidents, and the appallingly bad handling of the trial, the 15-year sentence, which was announced by Xinhua even before the court itself had pronounced it. But I think Deng Xiaoping and his associates thought the very giving of a trial would please us, even though we'll give the son of a bitch a trial before we hang him, sort of business. So that was in a different compartment of my mind.
Yeah. But you do think then that there is a universality to artistic expression and appreciation of the arts, that there are certain aesthetic senses that transcend cultural differences, do you think?
I think so. You know, the two Boston Symphony concerts that were given in the hall that they so quickly prepared and which seated about 2,000, that's one thing. They were practically all musical students, but then that crowd of 18,000 in the Workers' Stadium, when you could hear a pin drop, and Chinese audiences normally are not quiet. Mm-hmm. And again, the same tremendous reactive enthusiasm that they showed. That had to go beyond simply people educated in a cultural sense, I think.
Do you think that their cultural artistic modes of expression in China that would be equally appealing to Americans?
Yes, I think so.
What are they?
I think certain aspects of Peking opera. I think Peking opera in its totality would be, certainly to a modern American audience, would be rather deadly. but the acrobatics, certainly the scenes from the Monkey King sequence, I think would have a tremendously universal appeal. It's almost Chaplin-esque in that sense. And I think over time, some of their music, yes.
I'm inclined to agree, and also I think at traditional Chinese painting.
Oh yes.
And then its evolution in a more modern period, but which combines the abstract painting of France, the Impressionist traditions, with the brushstrokes of Chinese.
Right.
It's a very powerful artistic tradition.
And their ceramics, their their pottery, yes, the. In the physical sense, very much so.
Do you think, to what extent, after your experience in seeing a total array of exchanges between the United States and China, economic, military, etc., does culture, do these common cultural strands offer any meaningful way on which to build a more enduring relationship?
Oh, I think they're helpful in a minor sort of way, but I think to think that can be the basis for an enduring political association is not true. After all, the Germans not only they had created much of this culture we've been talking about. Music and so on, and didn't help very much in the 1930s and 40s.
It can be used to create a warmth,
yes,
and to ease forward movement in a
right,
relationship,
right.
But it can't be the driving power.
No, that's very true.
Maybe something like that.
In connection with the Stern visit, some of the older musicians were essentially his day-by-day hosts. Much of the conversation was through translators, but some of it in halting English. But quite early in his visit, he addressed something to his wife in Russian, because of course they were both born in Russia. And faces of the Chinese that they were sitting with lit up. You speak Russian. From
yeah,
then on,
right.
they had learned Russian during the 50s. From then on, all of their conversations were carried on in Russian.
Fascinating.
Now that was not true of the younger ones.
So that in the cultural side, there is really a generation there that is Russian oriented, you might say. They
certainly had been.
Yes. Well, but I think that even now, that among Western composers, I think it's the Russian romantics that evoke the most instant response from the Chinese. Tchaikovsky, I think, particularly. There's also Beethoven, strong appreciation for Beethoven.
Yes.
But I do not detect an interest in Bach or the chamber music. That music is not as well known. And does seem more alien. At least that's my very crude
right.
impression. And then you get Chopin, yes. And then I think it tails off with moving to the more modern, dissonant music, even when it's classic. But who am I thinking of? Several composers, major composers of the early night, Shostakovich even. Chinese, I think, begin to halt with that.
Yeah, I think they're traditionalists in that sense, but I think too they have a they seem to like Western music, our Western music, because I think of its fundamental rhythms. I never saw them exposed to any jazz to know what their reactions there were, although I think there were some jazz groups finally came to China. They like mass singing groups. The Ozawa came again by himself and put on a public concert with the Philharmonic and a chorus drawn from the PLA and other groups of Beethoven's Ninth. Sharon and I had just come back to Peking that same day from the United States. And luckily, it was the only item on the program, or I don't think we'd have been able to stay awake. But it was a very moving performance.
Let me add just one other thing along these lines of spring of 79, and there was a particular mood in the relationship at that time. It is hard to capture, but deserves to be. Do you think 3 years later that those of us who were involved in the relationship may have done too much to stimulate a feeling of warmth and therefore of undue expectations of what lay ahead?
Well, I think the feeling, the ambiance, was inevitable, because all the ingredients were there. And yes, I think it did, on both sides, lead to a feeling of a new day, and which didn't necessarily have immediate relationship to reality. But I don't think it was cultivated, and I don't think it could have. Oh, it could have been stopped, obviously. But it was a natural tendency, far more than anything else. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy, as we both know, to adapt to the warmth and the hospitality of the Chinese in any event. Practically all of the American groups that came felt so much at home and so much at ease. That was still true to the point I left in early 1981. When you talk to people who come back now, I think it still continues.
Well, we'll return to this theme of the affinity of at the individual level between Chinese and Americans. I do think there is something to that conventional wisdom. But
as I was saying, in the same period, in fact, on the same day, that Isaac Stern was at breakfast when he said, "Do you mind if I gave a concert here?" Joe Califano came to China with a delegation. He was greeted at the airport by the public health minister, Jiang Xinzhong, who surprised Joe, I think, by wrapping his arms around him and hugging him like a long lost brother. He always was an outgoing person, but he surprised all of us, as well as the secretary. And then he was greeted by Fong Yi in the Great Hall. Had a signing ceremony for a health agreement that had been negotiated. Met with all sorts of officials, the Vice Minister of Education, Li Xianyan, also at the Great Hall. And I must say, how should I put it? He certainly acted in a very in an unduly assertive way, I thought, with regard to the Chinese and with regard to apparent desire to get considerable exposure for himself.
And with the press.
With the press, I mean.